Hi, this is Michael Woodson of Living Art. You are listening to KPFT Houston.
You are hearing Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch, and that tells us that it is 6 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. We are aired only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston, or kpft.org HD1 on the internet. I'm Mary Edgerton, tonight's host, and along with the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on fabulous and fantastic journeys before returning us safely to the present. And do I have some stories for you tonight? My guest is Richard Munchkin. He describes himself as a writer, a director, and a professional gambler. Okay, when I saw that on his website, richardmunchkin.com, I knew I had to invite him to be on the show. I mean, what is a professional gambler? Yes, we know the country songs, but how about some real stories from someone who maintains a blog called Gambling with an Edge? So let's welcome Richard to the show.
So tell me about some of your stories.
Wow. Well, you know, I've been doing this over 40 years, so as you can imagine, I have a lot of stories.
So I have to ask you a question. I thought counting cards was illegal.
That is the first thing that people ask all the time. And no, it is not illegal, not in Las Vegas, not in any state in the United States, not in any country I've ever been in, is it illegal. But they have the right to ask you to leave in some states. So, for example, in New Jersey and Missouri, they're not allowed to tell you you can't play just because you're using your brain. And they find other ways to thwart us, you know, because they're not allowed to throw us out. But no, definitely not illegal.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So, and I'm just, this is just helping me get to know you because this is a storytelling show, not an
sure.
interview show. But is blackjack the only game you play?
No, I learned very early that blackjack, counting cards at blackjack, is a very small edge, and the casinos know the most about it. So I realized pretty quickly that what I needed to do was find a bigger edge and do things that the casino did not know about. And so very quickly, I moved on to other forms of what we call advantage play, or AP for short. And so really for the last, 30 plus years or more, if I get told I can't play anymore, it's not because they know what I'm doing. Either I won too much money or somebody in the casino has recognized me and they know that I'm not there to lose. I had this podcast, Gambling with an Edge, for 12 years. And on that show, I have another one now called Life is a Gamble. On that show, we have had players on that have beat every possible game in the casino that you can imagine. Every game can be beat under the right conditions. Now, most games, those conditions are going to be extremely rare, but they do occur. And we've had people who have beaten everything from craps roulette to state lotteries, everything. And I'm talking about a mathematical advantage, not like picking lucky numbers. I grew up in a suburb of Chicago where winters are brutal and people don't go outside. So what you do in the winter is play games. And so my dad taught me to play how to play chess when I was three, and my grandmother taught me gin rummy. And I loved to play, and it didn't matter what, cards, board games, whatever it was. And I was in high school, and my older brother invited some friends over to play poker, and they asked me if I wanted to join, and I said, sure. And we were playing literally for nickels and dimes, and at the end of the night, I was ahead $5.20. And it was like the heavens opened and the angels began to sing. I thought, oh my God, you can actually make money playing cards. And I thought this was the greatest thing in the world. So I went to the library the next day and I checked out all the books they had on poker. And so I read everything I could find, and we had this weekly poker game, and I was a consistent winner. And then backgammon became really popular in the 70s, mainly because of Hugh Hefner and Playboy magazine. It was the cool thing to do, and they started to have backgammon tables in bars and discos and things. And so I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to learn this game. And again, I went, I got all the books, and I started playing backgammon and playing in these weekly tournaments. And I went through college basically playing backgammon and poker. That was how I made my money while I was in college. And I was at a backgammon tournament at a local bar playing against Jerry the Dentist. And Jerry tells me that he has just come back from Las Vegas and he has a system for beating blackjack. And I roll my eyes and like, yeah, right. And he says, no, this is math. This is real. And he starts to explain counting cards to me. And he explains it. And I say, you know what, that sounds plausible. And he tells me about a book called Playing Blackjack as a Business. So I order the book, and when it comes in, I get the book and I devour it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is real. You can show, in black and white using math that this really has an advantage for the player. So I start practicing in my basement, dealing myself hands, learning the basic strategy. And now I have a plan. I am a theater major, and my plan is I am going to go to Hollywood and become a movie star. And I realize I need a solid backup plan. So if that doesn't work, I'm going to be a television star instead. But I'm not willing to go to Hollywood and wash dishes at night. So I think I will go to Las Vegas and make a bunch of money gambling and then go to LA to be a movie star. Now, I finish college, I pack up the car, and I drive to Las Vegas, and I don't have a lot of money. So I figure, okay, what I'm going to do is get a job dealing blackjack. And that way I could practice counting cards 8 hours a day. And then after work, I can go out and practice what I've been practicing. And that's what I do. So I'm dealing blackjack. I'm going out afterwards, and I'm just betting very small, $2 to maybe $10. But I'm starting to meet other card counters because I work in a casino that has a very good game, and all the card counters show up there eventually. And whenever I'm dealing to them, I talk to them about counting cards, which kind of freaks them out because dealers aren't supposed to know about counting cards, but I do, and I'm not going to bust them. I just want to talk about it because I'm so into it. So one day, one of these card counters comes to the casino and says, hey, there is a professional blackjack player from Australia in town, and he wants to play backgammon for a lot of money. And I say, set it up, whatever he wants to play for. Because at that time, I felt like there were only about 10 or 15 people in the world that were better than me at backgammon, and none of them were from Australia. So I was willing to play this guy for whatever he wanted to play for. So when I get there, it's a few days later, and he is staying on a big comp at the Desert Inn, and we go to his suite, and there's a bunch of other blackjack players there too. And the first thing he says to me is, look, I've done some asking around, and I hear that I'm outclassed at backgammon, so I don't want to play for a lot of money. And I was like, okay, that's fine. You know, we can play for small stakes, just, you know, a social game, have a good time. And that's what we do. All of us, there's a way to play backgammon with multiple people. And so we play every day and we order up lots of food from room service because it's free. And at the end of a week, he says to me, how come you're not playing blackjack for more money? And I said, well, I don't have a big bankroll. I'm just, this is what I can afford. And he says, well, how about I put up $20,000 and you play for me and you double it and then we split the money. And I said, you've known me a week and you're going to give me $20,000 to go gamble with in the casino and report back to you how I did? And he reaches in his coat and he pulls out two stacks of $10,000 and slides them across the table to me. This is $20,000 in 1980 dollars. And so I started playing. And we had a little team. And every time I went out to play, I would lose. And I would go to my teammates and I would say, I must be doing something wrong. Every time I play, I lose. Come sit with me at the table and watch me. Tell me where I'm making my mistakes. And they would come and they would sit with me and I would play and I would lose. And they would say, no, you're doing it right. You're just having a really, you know, bad streak. It'll turn around. And after a couple of months of this, I had played 167 hours on the table and I was losing about $16,000. And Alan, the Australian, he says, look, I'm sorry, but I have to go back to Australia. So I'm really sorry, but we have to end the bankroll. And I'm like, Alan, you're apologizing to me. I lost three quarters of your money. I'm the one who should be apologizing. Like, this is crazy. And he says, no, just stick with it. You know, it'll turn around. The math is the math. And so he left and I told my friends, I said, you know what? I'm just going to stick with my dealing job. I don't know if I'm the worst card counter in the world or just the unluckiest, but, you know, this sucks and I'm through. And I went back to my dealing job and one of my friends joined Alan's old team. And, you know, where in the beginning, when I was betting $2, they would bet 25. And where I was betting $10, they would bet two hands of 500. And after a few months of this, my friend comes to me and he says, look, you got to give this another shot. We're making money so fast. It's unbelievable. And just like the more we win, the more we start betting and win even more. He said, just give it another try. And I said, okay, I'll give it another shot. And I joined a team. I went out, I started playing, and now when I went out, instead of losing, now I was winning. And the more we won, the more we bet, and the more we bet, the more we won. And pretty soon I was making more money playing blackjack than I was dealing it. So I had to quit my job. And for basically 40 plus years, I got to travel around the world playing cards for a living.
Oh, that's amazing. Do you still do that?
Well, I
Or
say I'm
retired?
retired. My friends like to say that I'm retired until I get the right phone call, but actually I'm not retired now. I've just started getting into sports betting because sports betting has been proliferating across the United States. There are a lot of good opportunities now for sports betting.
And I presume you wouldn't call yourself someone with a gambling addiction.
So this is the problem with this profession, is especially when I was dating, because that is exactly what women thought when I would date them. And I tried to explain to them, it's not like I have a gambling addiction. It's like I own a brewery. And every bottle that goes by on the conveyor belt, I make 10 cents on. And that's what it is. When every hand of blackjack or whatever game I play, I'm making $1 or $4 or $6 or whatever it is. And that is the difference. It's the difference between an addiction and having an advantage and owning a business, basically.
Okay, so
So
it's a profession.
it is absolutely a profession. And the important thing is that you can demonstrate mathematically that you have an advantage. So, people who tell you that they can beat games like roulette or they have a system for craps or whatever, the roulette wheel doesn't remember what has happened. Even if seven, if red has come up seven times in a row, it's still basically 50-50 that red and black are going to come up the next time. But in blackjack, it's different. If all the aces come out on the first hand, I can't get a blackjack anymore. All the aces are gone. So what is left in the deck is dependent on what has already happened. And that's what makes it different than other games in the casino.
Wow, Richard, that is a great introduction to the concept of gambling as a profession and really as a field of applied mathematics. You've told us how you got started as a professional gambler, and we know you've been doing it for 40 plus years. How about another story? What happened after you went into it full time?
Okay, here's another one. 1983, I am sitting in a casino with my good friend Daryl in Leicester, England. And Leicester is 120 miles north of London. And I start to hear zzz, 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 zzz. And I'm thinking, this is not good. Because that sound is coming from a computer the size of a cell phone that is strapped to Daryl's calf. And this computer keeps track of every card that's played, and it keeps track of how the cards are shuffled so that after they're shuffled, we have information about what cards are coming next. Now, this is 1983. People don't have computers in their homes. If they've seen a computer, sometimes it'll take up an entire room. No one has ever heard of a computer that's the size of a cell phone that you could strap to your leg. So this is not illegal. There are no laws about using computers in casinos. And we are professional gamblers, so we are here to use this computer in this little casino in Leicester. We stick out in this place because we're two Americans in Leicester in the middle of winter, and there is nothing in Leicester other than a sock factory. And they don't get many tourists who come to visit the sock factory, but we're there and we play. And after a while, they start to change the way they shuffle the cards. And it's not good for us. It's not good for the way the computer is programmed. So we decide to stop. And we go to the cashier's cage, and the cashier says, I'm sorry, we don't have enough money to pay you. Now, this is the first time this has ever happened to us, and we have no idea what to do. This had never happened in Las Vegas or Atlantic City. And she says, well, we could give you a check. And we think, you know, this is not a good idea because we won't be back in the States for weeks. They could stop payment and it'll be in British pounds. We don't like that idea. And she says, well, how about take the chips with you and come back tomorrow and we will go to have gone to the bank and we will have enough cash to pay you. So we say, yes, that's what we're going to do. So we come back the next morning. And before we go, we have a big discussion. Should Daryl wear the computer again? Or should we leave it back in the hotel room? And we decide, you know, everything seemed very cool at the place. And maybe they're going to shuffle the cards the way we like it again. And we'll be able to play some more. So we decide, okay, Daryl's going to wear the computer. So we go back to the casino and he says, all right, I'm going to go to the cage and try to cash the chips. And you go to the table and see if the shuffle is good. I go to the table very quickly. I see the shuffle is not good. So we're not going to play anymore. So I get up, I go to the cashier's cage and Daryl's not there. And I say to the cashier, where's my friend? She says, what friend?
Oh, no.
I say, the big American guy with all the chips. And she says, oh, I think he went upstairs with his friends. I'm like, I'm his friend. I'm his only friend. He has no other friends. And I look up the stairs and there's like a bar or restaurant up there, but it's closed. It's dark. And I say it's closed. And she says, I think he went upstairs. So I go up the stairs. And as I go up, I'm starting to hear voices. And I come around the corner and here's Daryl. He's sitting on the couch and there's a guy sitting with him on the couch and another guy standing there. And I say, what's going on? And the guy on the couch next to Daryl says, are you a professional gambler too? And I say, what do you mean? And he whips out a badge and he says, Scotland Yard. And I said, have we done something wrong? And he says, no, we just want to make sure you are who you say you are. And I said, well, that's easy. Here's my passport, you know. And he looks at my passport, and then he wants to see my driver's license. And then he wants to see the car rental agreement. Now, we realized that what had happened was there were two casinos in Leicester. And we went to the first casino, and when we signed up, we had a policy. If they ask for our passports, we give it to them, and obviously they get our real name. All the casinos in England are private clubs at this point, so you had to join the club. If they didn't ask for a passport, we would give them a fake name. So because if eventually they said you can't play here anymore, we didn't want them to give our names to everybody else. So, you know, I'm John McCartney, and he's Paul Lennon, and, you know, well, at the first casino in Leicester, we signed up under fake names. But in this casino, fortunately, we had used our real names. When we won all this money, the casino owner called the other casino and said, did you have two Americans named this and that? And he said, well, we had two Americans sign up, but those weren't the names they used here. So they called Scotland Yard. So now, after they've looked at all our papers, now they say, we want to see your hotel room. Now, we're, you know, in our 20s. This is my first trip ever out of the country. You know, I don't know if I have rights. I don't know if I can say no. You know, so we say, okay. And I look down and I see hanging out of Daryl's pant leg is a blue wire. And now I'm starting to sweat and I'm thinking I have to keep my body in between these guys and Daryl so they don't see this wire hanging out of his pants. We make our way down the stairs to the car. I make him get in the back seat first so I can block their view. We get in the back seat. I tap his leg. I point to the wire, which he tucks in his sock. And we head back to the hotel. And the whole way there, we're working on these two cops. Like, do they do this to everybody who wins some money? And they would never do this in Las Vegas. Is this because we're Americans? You know, I mean, and the cops just keep asking us about being professional gamblers, which we keep denying. And all the way there, I'm thinking about back in the hotel room is a briefcase. And in that briefcase are extra batteries, extra switches that are operated by Daryl's toes, a soldering iron. There are registration cards for casinos all over Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, London, and all the fake names, and a yellow legal pad with the name of every casino we've been to and every fake name we've used in every casino and which ones we've used our real names. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, like when they see this, this is going to be a problem. And as I say, this computer is not illegal, but if they find it, we're going to jail that night until they find out whether there's a law against using a computer in a casino or not. So we're sweating all the way back to the hotel room. We get back to the hotel room and now they start searching and they're being thorough. They're going in between the towels in the closet and in every drawer in the bureau. But by now they're kind of feeling like this is a bunch of BS. Like they don't work for the casino. This is not like there's no crime going on here. And they're kind of coming over to our side. And now they start to make jokes. They find Daryl's guitar case and they open it up. They put it on the bed and say, "What's in here? A machine gun." And we're like, "Yeah, machine gun." As we're looking at the briefcase that is right on the end of the bed sitting there. And they open the guitar case and they close it again. They search everything in the room. And the only thing they haven't looked at yet is that briefcase. And the cop walks over to the briefcase and he opens it up and he's looking right at us and he says, "Well, I guess that's it then." And he closes the briefcase and he never looks down into it. And we're frozen and we're like, "Yep, that's it." And they say, "We'll take you back to the casino." And we say, "Okay. And what about our money?" And they said, "Well, that's something that you got to take that up with them. We don't have anything to do with that." And we get back to the casino and we go up and they cash the chips with no problem. We go back, get our car, drove straight to Dover and took the next ferry out of the UK. Because our names were just going to be spread to every casino, you know, in the UK. We knew we wouldn't be able to play anymore.
Have you ever been back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, a part of this job is every one of us, almost everyone that I know who does this for a living has had at least one legal name change. So you get a passport and a new name, and then you're able to go back. Some people more than once.
So is Munchkin your real name?
No. Now, well, so currently I have two different names, one on my passport, one on my driver's license, which sometimes leads to interesting conversations in airports. But neither of those names is Munchkin at this point. So I definitely could not use the name Richard Munchkin in a casino because between the podcast that I've done and the book I wrote, my name is pretty well known. And I have another problem in casinos now too, in that people have recognized my voice in casinos because of the podcast. So when I play now, I basically am a mute. I try not to speak at all.
So are there casinos that you can't return to?
Well, I mean, there are certainly casinos I've been told I can't return to. I mean, in the old days, they would throw me out on day shift and I would go back in on the night shift. Oh. Now the photographs that they take of you are much better. And so you can't quite do it that quickly. But, you know, if you wait 6 months, your photograph has gone down to the bottom of the pile and, you know, you can go back. But the other thing is that because casinos are now everywhere across the United States, you know, you can go to a different casino every day and not come back to the first one for many, many, many months.
And it's not illegal to have an edge. It's just undesirable.
Yes.
From a casino's point of view.
Yes, exactly. And some casinos are nice about it. They will say, you know what? You can play anything except blackjack. Or some will say, you know what? You can't play anymore. Feel free to use the restaurants or whatever. And then others will be, you are 86, and if you come back, you're violating trespass, and we will arrest you. And in the old days, they would sometimes handcuff you, drag you into the back room, photograph you. I had a friend who was beaten severely at a casino downtown. Two friends, actually, were beaten severely, broken ribs, ruptured spleen. And in the old days, lawyers in Nevada were afraid to sue the casinos because the casinos ran the state. But for the last 20 years or so, there is a lawyer who will sue the casinos, has won many, many cases against them because they were just violating people's civil rights.
Yeah.
You can't just, detain someone in handcuffs without cause,
And now we're going to take a break for station identification. We are a community-based storytelling radio show broadcast on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, also broadcast at 91.9 in Huntsville, 89.5 in Galveston, and anywhere on the internet as kpft.org HD1. Our show, So What's Your Story, is broadcast every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Central Time. But as you will hear, you can listen to the show after it has been aired. Yes, just visit our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, at houstonstorytellers.org, where you can replay any of our previous shows from So What's Your Story by selecting the radio show tab. Want to become a storyteller? Join the Houston Storytellers Guild and attend their monthly story swap on the fourth Tuesday of the month. Check out their calendar tab at houstonstorytellers.org and grab the Zoom information for the next virtual swap. The next story swap will be next week on November 28th, 7 p.m. Central Time, and November's theme is Thankful. You can also find other exciting events on the calendar, such as the next meeting of the San Antonio Storyteller Association, which is on the first Wednesday of every month. It is a hybrid event with both in-person and Zoom attendance. Another way to get into storytelling is by joining the Texas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. You can find them at TejasStorytelling.com. And they have both in-person and Zoom or hybrid events around the state on their calendar. Our friends at the Moth are back at Warehouse Live. The Story Slam is held on the second Tuesday of the month. Next one up is November 14th, and the theme is Give and Take. Check out themoth.org live storytelling events and their Facebook page, The Moth in Houston, for updates on their event and to buy tickets. And I just found a new venue. It's put on by the Personal Narrative Story Group, and every month they hold a 99-second Grand Slam with a series of 99-second stories. I just listened to the last one on November 5th, and it was great. You can find them on Facebook. Check out 99-second Grand Slams. And don't forget to join us next week, same story time, Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. So tell me this story about your gambling trip to Russia.
Okay, so I get a call from a former teammate, and he says, I found this great game, and I'd like you to go play. And I said, okay. And what that means is that 2 weeks later, I was going to strap $50,000 in cash to my body and fly off to Moscow. And I get to Moscow, and he has given me a list of many different casinos and where they are and how much he feels like I can win comfortably in those places. But things have changed, and the economy has changed in Moscow since the last time he was there. One of the first casinos I go to, I walk in the door, and they have metal detectors and guards there with wands, like at the airport or at a sports game. And I'm like, what's this about? And they were like, you're not allowed to bring your gun into the casino. And I'm thinking, how many people want to bring their guns into casinos here? And I go in and I start to play, and I'm at a table and I have a lot of chips in front of me. And a guy kind of comes up way too close to me. He entered, and I'm the only player at the table. There's plenty of space, but he comes up and I sort of feel him, and I kind of block him away from my chips, and he just makes a U-turn and leaves. And maybe 20 minutes later, the same guy comes up, and now I'm in the middle of a hand, and he comes up again right next to me, shoulder to shoulder, and he hands in some money. And as he's handing in the money, I see some chips fall off one of my stacks. Now, there's an old scam in Las Vegas where people would put something sticky on their hand, on the back of their hand, and as it passes over your chips, one of them sticks to their hand, and all of my chips are worth either $100 or $500. And so now I'm really looking at his hand to see if he's taken one of my chips, but he kind of quickly puts it into his pocket, and I really don't know for sure if he got anything or not. So I don't say anything. The guy plays like one hand and leaves the table. And a while later, the casino manager comes over and he's sort of hosting me because I'm a big player in the casino. And I say, hey, look, I don't know if this was anything or not. And I tell him this story. And he says, well, let me go look at the video, because every table in the casinos, both in Las Vegas or there in Moscow, has a camera focused on it, at least one. And he comes back a while later and he says, you know, I looked at the video and I could very clearly see that your chips fell off of your stack when he passed his hand over it, but I could not tell if he took any of your money. He said, but we know that player. He's a regular here. And when he's no longer here in the casino, but when he comes ask, we will ask him. And I sort of laughed and I said, well, there's no way the guy's, if he took my chips, he's not going to tell you that he took them. And the guy looks at me with these cold, dead eyes and he goes, oh, he will tell us. And the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And my thought was not about, oh my God, I'm in danger. My thought was, oh, I would not want to be that guy when they drag him into the back room to see if he took any of my money. So that was my first clue that things were not the same as they normally are when I was here in Moscow. So after that, I go to another casino and I walk in, and the casino is supposed to be inside a hotel. And I get to the lobby and I don't see a casino anywhere. And I look and I see a nightclub, but it's closed and dark. So I go to the front desk and I say, where's the casino? And they point me to the nightclub. So I say, it's closed. And they go, no, just go in there. So I go through this dark nightclub and I see in the back a window with a porthole, a door with a porthole window with light coming through it. And I head back there and I open the door. I go in and it's a very small casino. There's only about six tables. There's only two players in the place, a guy and his girlfriend. And I sit down and I start to play. And now this had absolutely nothing to do with my skill as a card counter or anything else. I just got lucky. I just won every hand. And this can happen periodically. And so I only played through one shoe. And at the end of that shoe, I could look at the pit boss and I could see he was not looking like he was feeling very well. And I thought, you know, I think this is about all this can take here at this little casino. I better stop here. So I pick up my chips and I go to cash out. And now this manager is the cashier. And he says to me, I'm very sorry, but I don't have enough money to pay you. And now this has happened to me in the past. And you never get angry. You don't raise your voice. I said, how much do you have? And he goes over to the table and he gets my money back out of the box that I used to buy in. And he gives me that and about another $1,000 or so. And I'm left with 22 $1,000 chips. And he says, the owner will be here tomorrow. Come back tomorrow and he will have your money. And I say, okay. And I take the 22,000 and I leave. And I call my friend back in the States, and his name is Art. And I tell Art what happened, and he says, okay, look, there's a guy there who runs the poker room at the Cosmos Casino. His name is Jeff. He's Australian. Go talk to Jeff, because he's been living there in Moscow for years. He knows all the casinos. He'll know what to do. I say, okay. So I go to the Cosmos. I find Jeff. And Jeff says, oh, yeah, they can't afford that much. They don't have that $22,000 to pay you. And he goes, look, here's the situation. In Russia, the police and the court systems are totally ineffectual. Every business has what's called a roof. And your roof is your local mob guy. And you pay every month protection to that mob guy. And if you have some kind of a dispute, you don't go to the police or the courts, you go to your roof. He says, now you're in luck, because that casino, their roof is Chechen mob. And my roof here at the poker room is also Chechen mob, but my roof is higher than their roof. Would you take 18,000 for the 22,000 in chips? I said, done. Yes, let's do it right now. I'm happy to, you know, take the $4,000 discount. He says, well, no, we have to wait and talk to my roof. And I say, okay, but look, this is Saturday night, and Monday morning, I'm supposed to be on a flight back to the States. So I really want to get this done, because I do not want to have to postpone this flight. So he says, my roof should be here tomorrow. So I say, okay, fine. I go back the next night. I'm there. Jeff says, he's not here yet. He'll be here later. I have to leave. He goes, I'm going to another poker game at another place. This is Natasha. She'll take care of you. And he introduces me to Natasha, who works there in the poker room. And she's dark and mysterious and kind of sexy, but in a dangerous kind of way. Like, if you slept with this woman, you might not live through it. And I say, okay. And so I'm waiting. And after a few hours of sitting there, Natasha comes up to me and says, we go. And I say, we go where? And she says, to get your money. I say, okay, great. And so we jump in a cab and we go to the casino. And when we pull up in front of the hotel, I see through the front doors, there is a little guy with two huge guys standing on either side of him. And they're all wearing black turtlenecks and black suits, straight out of Central Casting. We go walking into the lobby, and I look over at the casino, and they now have a metal detector, and they have two huge guys. And those guys are pacing back and forth like caged lions. They are not happy to see these guys in the lobby of the hotel. And Natasha talks to the little guy, and he keeps shaking his head. Okay, no problem. And she says, okay, we go. We're going inside. So now we head over to the entrance where the guards are. And as we're going, they start saying something to the guys behind me, and those guys start answering back, and they're talking in Russian, and the volume is getting louder and louder. And as I get to the metal detector, one of the guards grabs me by the wrist and starts pulling me into the casino. And one of the guys behind me grabs my other wrist and starts pulling me out. And they're now playing tug of war with me while they're shouting at each other in Russian. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing? What? I just want to play cards and get paid when I win. And I never thought this is what was going to happen. I thought we were just going somewhere to pick up my $18,000, not come here and get into a melee. And I kind of pull away and we back out into the lobby. And Natasha says, those men don't want these men to go inside. And I said, yeah, I got the message. And she goes, just you and me. We go in. If they have your money, great. We come back out. If not, don't say anything. We just turn around and come back outside. And I say, okay. So Natasha and I now go into the casino. We get to the door with the window and the porthole, and we go inside, and it's the same manager there, and he is white and sweated. And he says, this is very bad. You should not have brought those men here. And I said, do you have my money? And he says, I have some. I said, how much? He says, 1,000. So I give him one chip and he gives me $1,000. And he says, you come back in a week, 2 weeks, I give you another 1,000. Another week, 2 weeks, another 1,000. I said, look, I'm getting on a plane for America tomorrow morning. So if you don't have my money now, you will have to give the money to those men. And he's like, oh no, only you can collect this money. And I said, well, you'll have to take that up with them. And Natasha and I go back out to the lobby. And she tells the guy what happened, and he nods his head, okay, okay, no problem, no problem. Give me the chips. And I was like, well, Jeff said you would give me $18,000 for the chips, and I don't want to give up the chips until I get my $18,000. And he says, okay, you give the chips to Jeff. And I said, okay, all right, fine. So now we go back to the Cosmos poker room. Jeff's not there. I call Jeff. Jeff says, okay, just give the chips to Natasha. I was like, no, Jeff, you know, I want the $18,000 when I give up the chips. And he's like, all right. He goes, just before you go to the airport in the morning, come back down and, you know, Natasha will have the money for you. So I say, okay, I go up. I can't sleep at all. I repack my suitcase like 4 times, pace the room, take 3 showers. Finally, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. I go back down to the poker room. Here's Natasha. She worked all night, works all day. I don't know how she does it. And sure enough, she has my money. I get the $18,000. I jump immediately in a cab. I head to the airport and I get on a plane and fly home. And it wasn't until I was on the plane that just I had that adrenaline crash where I just, you know, my whole body, I felt like I wanted to go to sleep. And I just thought, what the hell am I doing? Why am I doing this? This is absolutely crazy. You know, I now had a wife and young children, and I just decided I am no longer willing to go somewhere that I feel might be dangerous. So a friend called me to go to Colombia when they had open casinos there. I was like, no, thanks. Guy called me, you want to go to Iowa in the middle of winter? Okay, not the best, but I'll go. And then a guy calls, oh, they opened some casinos in Mexico. They're run by drug cartels. Hard pass. But for 40 years, I've been able to fly around the world making a living playing cards. And for me, you know, life doesn't get much better than that.
Richard, what a rich life you have lived. As you mentioned, this profession has taken you all over the world. We had a tense time in the UK and a very scary time with you in Russia. How about a travel story that doesn't quite keep us on the edge of our seat, making sure that you get home safely?
So my friend Alan from Australia is now living in Hong Kong, betting horse racing there. And he calls me up and he says, I have this really good game. I'd like you to go play for me. And I said, you know, I'm part of a team and I feel obligated to them. And I can't really just leave them and go play with somebody else. And he says, well, I'll tell you what, how about the whole team goes to play? And whatever you guys are going to bet, just bet twice as much and I'll take the other half of the action. And I say, okay, fine. And the game, it turns out, is in Seoul, South Korea. So I fly off to Seoul and Alan tells me, you need to change the money, the dollars, into Korean won, but you don't want to do it at a bank or the casino because you'll get a terrible rate. And you can get 10% more if you trade it on the black market. And I say, okay, how do I do that? And he says, there's a guy who lives there in Seoul, an American guy who is also a blackjack player, and he knows everything about, you know, what's going on there. So here's his name. His name is Marty. You get a hold of Marty. And he tells me how to get a hold of him. So I get a hold of Marty. Marty says, yeah, I'll take you to the black market. Everything will be good. So I meet him in this shopping area in Seoul called Itaewon. And he takes me off the main street, down a block, and into an alley. And the alley is called Fish Alley because it is lined with shops, many of them selling fish that are all out there on ice. But they're also selling, you know, all kinds of pillows and suitcases and knockoff tennis shoes and everything you can imagine. But the smell is mainly fish. We go down Fish Alley for a block, and then we turn right into a residential neighborhood, and he takes me to this guy's house. And he introduces me to the guy. His name is Mr. Kim. He says, Mr. Kim will take care of you. And Marty leaves. Mr. Kim invites me into his home. It is a traditional Korean home. There is no furniture. There are pillows on the floor and a safe in the corner. And we sit down and he says, you know, how much do you want? And I say $20,000. And he says, do you have hundreds or less? And I say hundred. And he writes on a piece of paper, he will pay this much for $100 bills and less than that for other kinds of bills. Who knew, right? I was like, no, I have hundreds. So he says, okay. And he shows me the price. He takes a calculator. He punches it in for the $20,000. He shows me how much won it should be. I say, yes. And now he very carefully counts out the $20,000, makes sure it's all there, picks it all back up, sticks it in the safe, closes the door, and says, come back at 7 o'clock. And I say, no, what? No, no, no. Give me back my money. He says, no, just come 7 o'clock. I'm like, no, problem, big problem. Give me back my money. He says, it's okay. I'm like, no, not okay. He gives me a big sigh. Okay. He opens the safe again. He gives me back the $20,000. He says, come back 7 o'clock. I have your money. I say, okay. So now I leave. Now I'm coming back at 7 o'clock. It's dark. Fish Alley is closed. It's really dark. There's no streetlights in the alley. And the average income in Korea at this time is $200 a month. And this guy knows I am coming down this dark alley with $20,000 in cash. And I start down the alley and I'm thinking, this is crazy. And the smell, it's like kimchi bottling season for the winter. So the smell of garlic and chilies is just thick in the air. And every step I take, I'm going, this is crazy. I shouldn't be doing this. But how do I not do it? How do I tell my teammates, like, oh, I was afraid to go get the money because it was dark. I'm afraid, you know, and I just, so I just keep going. And I finally get to his house and I go inside and he has the money. And now I'm thinking, now I have to leave with all the money. You know, maybe they're waiting for me to get here and now they're going to get me on the way out. But he has all my money. I change all the money. I take it. I say, thank you. I get up and I leave and I rush down I go down the block and I run out of the alley. And over the next 4 years, I did transactions with this guy 50 or 100 times. And I know today that I absolutely could have left him my $20,000 and he absolutely would have had my money, because this turns out that the black market is a sort of an honorable business in Korea, and every neighborhood had one. And he couldn't rip somebody off because of what it would do to his reputation. But it made my perspective of going to new countries so different. to not go in with kind of my judgment about what I thought this country was about and how people were going to act.
So, well, this has been great. And I will let you know when I'm either going to broadcast it in November or December.
Okay.
I come up once a month. And so I'll go through. These are a great set of stories, and I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever be a counter because I don't think I have the concentration.
Yeah. 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 It sounds like you're better off playing poker.
Yeah. Yeah. With friends.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much and have a great day.
Okay. Thank you.
And that brings this storytelling show to an end. Thank you, Richard Munchkin. We will be back next week with more tellers and new journeys. But don't leave. Stay tuned into KPFT because next up is Living Art with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson, a community art program that hosts artists from around Houston, including poets, writers, performance artists, visual artists, car artists, and others engaging in educating, promoting, and advancing art and artists in our Gulf Coast region. So just chill. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just hanging, join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a great way to make the commute go by. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end the way you want, remember, it's the journey and not the destination. Peace.